This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in June of 2018 when Hobart and William Smith Colleges set out to find a new president. The colleges didn't expect to need to find a president so soon. Back in 2017, Hobart and William Smith hired Gregory Vincent, who served less than a year on the job. He resigned following allegations that he committed acts of plagiarism in writing his doctoral thesis at the University of Pennsylvania. This week, the colleges welcomed their first woman president. Joyce Jacobson started the job on Monday. She comes to Geneva from Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where she served as provost and senior vice president for academic affairs. But her resume is much longer and more colorful than that. In this hour, we're going to talk about the work she's done regarding gender studies and economics, labor, even the economics of wine. A lot to talk about with Dr. Jacobson, the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And we are broadcasting from our studios in WEOS in Geneva. It's always great to be here with Greg and Kelly and the entire team here at Hobart and William Smith. Dr. Jacobson, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, there's a great picture of you on social media of you standing next to a statue of Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell, and you got a big smile on your face. Tell us about Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell.
Well, I talked about it a bit when I first came to campus to be welcomed in February. I mean, Elizabeth Blackwell was one of my childhood heroines. I was one of those nerdy kids who liked to go to the library. Every Sunday we'd go with my mother and I would walk, get a big handful of books. I'd read some there. And I always liked the biography section. And one of my favorite biographies was of Elizabeth Blackwell. And I read it several times. So when I found out, actually before I applied for this job, I did know a little bit, but I certainly learned a lot more about the connection of the colleges to Elizabeth Blackwell. I was really excited about it.
And here you are now. You started, I guess, officially just a couple of days ago, but I know the work began pretty soon after the announcement here. A lot of excitement on campus, and I think some surprise that you're the first woman in this job. Does that mean anything extra to you?
Well, I think it's a nice symbolism, particularly for these colleges, because of the coordinate system, the fact that the William Smith College came along later and was founded very much for women's rights and at a time when women didn't have great access to education. And so the symbolism of having this coordinate system now have its first woman leader, I think, is important.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a moment about some of the work that you've done in something, a field of occupational segregation. We'll talk about how you see that. And listeners, if you want to weigh in on a wide range of subjects with the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call us toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. The previous president, Gregory Vincent, you know, this resignation, it wasn't the biggest scandal in academia, but certainly was not what Hobart and William Smith expected. Is there any extra pressure on you knowing that you're following something that sort of unsettled the schools here? How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, it was a great opportunity for me in the sense that then I was able to have this job. And so I guess that I'm just happy to be here. I don't really know that much about President Vincent's time. I have had the pleasure of speaking to all the four former presidents who are still alive of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, either by phone or in person, had great conversations with all four of them, really trying to learn about their time here and what they did. And I think I can learn from all four of their careers, as well as reading up on the past history as well. So I don't see it as any particular aspect of burden or promise in either way. It's something that happened before I was here. I don't know that much about it.
What's priority one for you here?
Priority one has really been already trying to learn about the school and understand all the narratives that go on in a community, a complex community like a college, including its relationship to the town area, the city that it's in, Geneva in particular. Just had lunch this morning actually with the city manager, Sage Gerling. So really trying to reach out to all the constituencies, whether it's alumni, faculty, staff, students, other people involved with the colleges in all forms and the local community, and just hear their various narratives about what the college means to them, how they've interacted with it, what their hopes are for the colleges, what their concerns are for the colleges, and just taking all that in. It's a holistic process, which will probably take me, well, potentially years and years, but certainly these first few months, really a steep learning curve to get all that knowledge in.
If I've done the proper homework, it indicates to me that your arrival here was at least preceded by some experience of the region as a lot of people experience the Finger Lakes, especially Northeasterners, but the hope in this region is that we're starting to draw people in a tourism sense to the wine scene, to the agricultural scene, frankly, to the lakes themselves. What was your experience here in the region, and then what came to mind when this job became open?
Well, I do have some friends who have a lake house down in Pinon, about halfway up the lake on this side. And so we'd been visiting them every summer for the last few years as they've been working on the house. And actually, just last summer, we'd come up to Geneva for lunch. We're having lunch here and then walked along. And I think, well, what beautiful buildings, what a lovely college campus. So who knew, you know, a year later I would be here. So it's been exciting because I have seen that from visiting them. I did come up many years ago, more often too. I had a grand aunt and uncle that lived actually in Turin. They'd retired there from Waterville, and so knew this area, had been to Rochester and Buffalo, and went to Niagara Falls years ago with the kids. So clearly it's really improved, though, certainly since when I came here in the late 70s and early 80s to visit my relatives. And it's just striking how the whole gastrotourism industry has improved this area, how exciting that is for Geneva in particular, but the region more generally. And really looking forward, my husband and I, to exploring more in the region now that we're actually living here full time.
How do you like the pace of it?
Well, the pace is good. Again, Middletown wasn't exactly a bustling metropolis. It was 45,000 instead of 15,000, but it's not that different. It's nice to be out of the main game. I like to visit New York City, I always say, but I don't think I would want to live there. It's just a little too exciting. And the clean air up here and waking up every day and getting to look out my front door and see that wonderful view of the lake is priceless.
This might be perceived as a little bit too much of a softball, but I'll ask you anyway, because now that you're in the president's role, I suspect you'll say some really strong and positive things, but to the best that you can remember, before you were even thinking about becoming the first woman to lead this these schools, what was the reputation that you were aware of with Hobart and William Smith?
Well, I had very positive views of it. I knew academics who were here. I knew people in the economics department by reputation. I knew a couple of the former provosts professionally, and very positive. Again, it was well known for having a strong faculty and being a serious institution.
You had to make some decisions on if you want to move here, if you and your husband want to live here, and a chance to lead schools means what to you? Are you here to shape, to change directions? I mean, how do you view the role of what you're about to undertake here?
Well, the challenge is always to continue to build and preserve what is strong about an institution and figure out things that can make it even stronger. I watched that happen at Wesleyan under the president I worked with there and the former presidents, that it got stronger and stronger, and the city came up as well over this period. So Middletown is substantially a nicer place to live. I think everybody there would agree over the last 25 years that I was there. I'm hoping I can participate in the continuing growth and renaissance that's occurring in Geneva and help add to that, both for the college's sake specifically, but for the region and the city as well.
We talked about your long resume. It includes some work in gender studies, but that's a term that, you know, has a wide range of different ideas attached to it. So I want to ask you generally about that, and then we're going to kind of get into economics if we could. Generally speaking, how have you seen the field of gender studies grow and change in your career in academia?
Well, it's certainly grown and become more established. It was started, of course, before I really became an academic. So when I came to my first job, which was actually at Rhodes College in Memphis, I joined a reading group there that was reading through some of the classics of feminist literature. And that was a real eye-opener for me because economics was not a particularly feminist-oriented field. That said, I had already started doing work in graduate school on gender patterns. I was interested in questions like, why do women make less than men? Why are women and men found in very different occupations and industries, and studied that as part of my dissertation work. But I hadn't had the full reading of feminist theory to think more about alternative narratives of why we see those patterns. And I've learned a lot more about that since I started my professional life.
And so when it comes to that nature and nurture question, that why do men choose certain fields? Why do women choose certain fields? This is at the heart of a lot of recent debates about what might parity look like if you somehow eliminate all the variables, which obviously you cannot do. But do you think, generally speaking, if there is a field where there's a lot more men than women, or a field where there's a lot more women than men, that more often is going to be based on sort of social impact, how society is sort of structured, how kids are raised, or is that more biologically based?
Well, I would lean towards the socialization side. And there's interesting examples of professions and occupations that have shifted over time. For instance, we think of clerical work as being a very female-typed or female gender-typed occupation. But if you look back historically, if you think about the Dickens books, it's a bunch of men sitting around in frock coats with pens working on ledgers. And so that was really a male occupation in the 19th century and only switches later, partly in this country after the Civil War, because there were fewer men and women were able to enter in. So there are larger stories about patterns of patriarchy and domination that explain part of the patterns historically and really say that much of what we see in terms of when we think of an occupation as gender type one way or the other can really change over time. Professors is another example. Professors were all male, and now, of course, the majority of professors are actually female. It's actually tipped as a profession to changing in that way.
And so, you know, before the program began, we talked a little bit about the Google case, James Damore, who wrote that memo that went sort of viral, and his allegation that, well, you know, there may be certain fields like tech, in his view, that just naturally attract more men. Do you think that's too simplistic?
Certainly, because it ignores a lot of other things about the style of work in industries, that industry may have very unfamily-friendly patterns in terms of the hours required and the structure of your life, which make it harder for women potentially to go in if they still have more responsibility for child raising, for instance. And so it's hard to say that it's the intrinsic aspect of the job as opposed to the social milieu in which it's found that could determine it. And really, I find the nature-nurture divide overly binary, shall we say. There's very interesting new research that shows that nature responds to nurture, even at a very genetic level. There's interesting research actually on plants right now that talk about growing up in different environments and how that actually changes the next generation of plants. So there's increasing evidence that you really can't draw the line between these two areas so clearly. And that brings, of course, we don't experiment on humans the way we do on plants, but it really brings up interesting questions about how genetics actually responds to environment.
And that is very interesting. And then so in the field of just economics, the workforce, there's plenty of evidence that when we see at least a little more opportunity extended to men and women, that we tend to see a little bit more of an evening out of who is going into certain fields?
Oh, sure. I mean, classic examples. I mean, the whole saga of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where she's become a real folk heroine, gives an example of that, where there were doors closed. It was very hard for women to get into law school. It was hard for women to get a first job out of law school. And then she ends up being a Supreme Court justice. So when you open those doors, particularly if you make it easier for women to go through these formal doors, we've seen the number of women going to MBAs and to law school and PhDs just increase enormously. And so it's hard to say that we have ever really gotten rid of all the barriers when people point to occupations and still claim that those are for men or that they are for women.
We've seen a Canadian psychologist, Jordan Peterson, pick up millions of followers by arguing that too often, whether it's in academia or elsewhere, the argument is that we need to have equal outcomes for men and women, as opposed to equal opportunity, that we're trying to force equal outcomes even when it's not natural. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think there's a natural question about equal outcomes, but it's true that if equal opportunity were granted and then people are choosing without any social constraints, which again is a very difficult experiment to run, that we might well see a very different pattern than we see now. And without saying, acknowledging the social constraints that operate on both women and men, there are many occupations that men may not feel comfortable going into as well. Nursing is an example, for instance, that it's hard to say what things would look like if people really were in an environment that didn't retain the binary to the extent that we still do today, shall we say.
And so do you think women on this campus are going to see you and maybe, you know, it's not going to change every aspect of their lives, but does it change anything into what they see in terms of who's in a position of power here, how they're viewing the world?
I think it's certainly always important to have role models and people just like Elizabeth Blackwell so that you think, well, this is something that I can do. And it's not just about gender. It's about racial groups. It's ethnic groups. It's socioeconomic. It's age. There's so many barriers to full representation. And every time we see somebody that pushes against the stereotypes for a particular group, it's very valuable to expand people's minds and say, well, you know, there is actually not a reason why people of that type couldn't be doing this thing.
My guest is Dr. Joyce Jacobson, the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, the first woman ever in that position, and just started officially on the job this week, coming from Wesleyan University in Connecticut, but with a long background and bringing with her a lot of experience in different fields. So Joyce Jacobson, our guest for the hour, and if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. I'll read a couple of comments and emails in just a moment here. And you can also find us on various platforms and social media as well. So the conversation is happening right here at WEOS, our partners here in Geneva, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. And we always appreciate working with our colleagues and coming down here to Geneva. Gary writes to us to say, considering the concerns regarding deplatforming of controversial speakers by uninviting guests, the heckle veto and harassment of minority political philosophies on many campuses, what is the president's position on free speech on campuses in both the public forum and in the classroom?
Oh, that is a great question, and it is such a topical issue. I think if you look at my record and what we were doing at Wesleyan was really trying to make clear that free speech is the primary goal or primary standard. It's very challenging to navigate that on college campuses, and we certainly had a lot of challenges at Wesleyan with that. But my belief is that free speech is a fundamental standard for us and colleges, that it actually owe it to our students to have them hear multiple types of voices and understand different points of view. And we wouldn't be doing our educative job if we don't do that, partly because they need to understand reasoned counterpositions to beliefs that they hold. And for any position that you hold, there is at least one, if not more, often two or three or five counterpositions. So that said, I hope we don't end up in situations where that happens. I'm hoping that Hobart and William Smith students are open to that view also, but that also that we do have to be careful sometimes with campus safety issues. If there is a speaker that's viewed as being particularly provocative, that we also don't want to cause a situation of potential panic or harm to others. And so obviously that's a delicate line to walk. I would like to always err on the side of free speech, but sometimes there are cases where we have to at least control the situation. I would not like to go to a situation of disinviting people, however.
I think the generally speaking, and I'm going to speak very broadly here, I think the conservative critique is that right now they view college campuses as too often deplatforming in some fashion. Is that a fair critique right now?
I don't know if it's true across all college campuses. There have certainly been very well-noted cases of that happening, Middlebury being one of the first ones that came along with Charles Murray's speech. That said, there are many controversial speakers, or at least speakers espousing views that maybe aren't as famously controversial, but actually when you talk to them or listen to them, are pretty controversial, and they visit campuses regularly, often invited by faculty members as part of regular seminar series, and they are able to deliver their speeches in a very moderate way, moderate in the sense of the reaction of the audience, of actually having a reasoned dialogue and discussion with the person. At Wesleyan, we actually invited many speakers on what I would consider the conservative right-hand side, because Wesleyan was a very progressive campus. It was more that we felt we needed to actually actively bring speakers on the right than on the left at that point. And so we were doing that. And really, most of the speakers we brought, when they were brought by the faculty or sponsored by the Dean of Social Sciences, where he and I worked together on this project, it actually turned out to work out just fine. I think students appreciated the variety of views, and they found it educational, and we found really no pushback from the community. So I think it can be done in a way that's reasoned and respectful, and also that we really want to invite speakers that are educative in the sense that they have a well-reasoned platform and explication for their beliefs, and that those people are highly welcome on our campus and indeed encouraged.
Yeah. Is there an example of a speaker that you brought to Wesleyan who might have been either deplatformed elsewhere or somebody who stands out that maybe there was some initial concern?
I'm trying to think if there are any specific examples of the, I mean, they may well have been deplatformed and I didn't know about in other cases. We had a lot of interest in both pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian speakers. We brought both of those, for instance. Mm-hmm. There may occasionally be picketing. We once brought Justice Scalia to campus. There was picketing on that, but he continued to talk without problem. We say as long as the protest wasn't disruptive of the program to the extent where the person couldn't continue to speak or other people asked questions, then we would allow protest of a silent or non-disruptive nature. Certainly any picketing outside buildings we found fine, and even protests within the building, so long as, again, it allowed the program to continue. And Scalia, I think, had actually a great visit, had both small group interactions with faculty and students, as well as a public lecture. To this day, I think of that as one of the most important things we did during my time there.
Hmm. You referenced the Charles Murray incident, pretty well known. Was that a mistake in how it was handled?
Well, I think there was some question about how much Middlebury understood what was going to transpire. It was not a campus that traditionally had had a more provocative history. At Wesleyan, we're pretty much always ready for this because it happens pretty much every week. So it was not, I think we're more battle tested at Wesleyan than many of the other schools. And so I think Middlebury didn't see it coming, but they're certainly up to speed now. And I think they, you know, looking back, there may be things they would have liked to do differently if they thought through their protocols. But given the situation, they did what they thought was appropriate at the time.
Do you think speech can be violent?
Speech can provoke violence. There are certainly cases of that, and how people react to speech can be in a violent way. Again, I would hope that on most college campuses that students actually would not react that way. Some of the problems on campuses have been from outside persons also coming on and acting as provocateurs rather than it coming from the student body. I think that's also an issue for campuses. We like to keep our campuses open and allow other people to come. At times when we think they might be disruptive in ways that are detrimental, though, we would as a private school have the right to ask them to leave.
I think examining all of these issues is important with people in positions of power like yourself. I think trying to understand what's happening on campuses is important. I also think, yes, there have been incidents of deplatforming, but I think sometimes things get caricatured. Sometimes I think the current narrative about college students being soft or not wanting to hear other views, I sort of feel like every generation gets older and says kids these days. I mean, are we caricaturing college campuses, or do you think that some of those critiques are fair?
No, I do think that's true. And if you read back histories of colleges, and I've read both the Wesleyan history, and I'm still working through the Hobart one, but Hobart and Winsmith, but I'm getting there, that you see that there's a history going back to really the founding of colleges of all the concerns we hear now. So Wesleyan, for instance, was 1831. It's a little younger than Hobart College from 1822. But if you read the earlier years, you already see all the complaints we see now. People spending too much time doing things other than studying, too many student clubs, too much drinking, faculty doing too many other things and complaining there's too many committee meetings. It's all the same story. It just repeats over and over again. So every generation goes through this, and partly it's related to what students are doing at their age range. So again, particularly in traditional campuses where the majority of students are 18 through 22, they're going through particular developmental phases that relate partly to what we see. And those phases, while they've changed somewhat with social structures over time, are still in some sense fundamental.
Angela says, Evan, I can't believe the first president of William Smith to be a woman. Why does your guest think that she is the first? I think Angela is implying, how come it's taken so long?
Oh, as opposed to that, I'm wrong on one of the other people. Again, I think sometimes people are just chosen for the right reasons. I mean, Mark Guerin had a very long career here. 18 years is particularly long for a presidency. So partly it just relates to when presidencies turn over and who they think is the best people for the job when it happens.
You don't think there was a single woman before you that should have been in the... it's hard to believe that there wouldn't have been one woman before you who would have been qualified, who wanted this job.
Well, it could have been, but then there's other things that matter too. So you could be qualified. And again, being qualified for a college presidency is a good question. What makes you qualified? You don't have to be an academic. We see people come in from non-academic positions. And sometimes it's just the call of the selection group of saying what seems to be the best fit right now. I don't know what the pool was like for the other searches.
No, that's fair. Yeah, I know you weren't in the room there.
I wasn't there.
I have read that you've thought about, at least in some fashion in the future, maybe not right away, teaching here. Would you teach here?
Well, I am a tenured member now of the economics department, and I really appreciate that my colleagues welcomed me and encouraged me to stand for tenure already. And so that's a great thing. I would like to teach either on my specialty area of gender economics or feminist economics, but also I might even just enjoy teaching an intro class in economics. At Wesleyan, I taught everything from the very basic introduction class for people who had no economics before up through our most technical class on econometrics for advanced statistical analysis. I like teaching all types of economics. I just think it's a really cool area, frankly, and I would love to get back to teaching. Probably not right away, because I have so much to learn right now myself, but eventually I would like to also experience the colleges by being a teacher here.
I was reading recently, Anand Giridharadas was debating Art Laffer, and his complaint, Giridharadas's complaint was that we are slow to change our views on economic theory, even in light of landslides of evidence, and his frustration that when it comes to economics, it's hard to discredit anything in this country. You know, tax cuts always equal growth and that kind of question. And by the way, conservative listeners, I'm not saying tax cuts never equal growth. I am saying that Art Laffer's had a lot of evidence presented against some of his ideas, and Giridharadas was just observing that it takes a long time to move the needle on what's accepted as a good or a bad idea economically. What do you think?
Well, I think economics has had a long and industrious career of theories that work part of the time, and macroeconomics is a particularly challenging area because it's so hard to predict what's going to happen in the future based on the past. Theory gives us some guide to that, past data gives us some guide, but the profession has been caught many times with really only being able to explain what happened 10 years after whatever it was that happened. I mean, we're still actually arguing in the profession about exactly what caused the Great Depression. So I don't think of economics as being the best forecaster field. I think economics actually is most powerful in when it tells you what you don't know. And I always think if you succeed as a teacher when you teach students to not be so sure about things. I once had a student, I've always thought this was one of the greatest things I heard. I had a student I knew pretty well, and senior year she was about to graduate, and I asked her what she learned, what things she learned most importantly at Wesleyan, and she said, "I learned when I came here, I thought I knew a lot, and now I know I don't really know anything." And that's actually what maybe I don't think it's just the liberal arts, but in general, obviously, if you learn technical fields, hope you learn how to do something, but that you need to be humble about how much you don't know and how much there is to know in the world, and always be suspicious of people who think they do know the answer to things. So I think economics, some of the most powerful theorems in formal economics are impossibility theorems about how you can't design a voting system that accurately reflects preferences for a group of people, how you can't solve general equilibrium for economy. There are so many interesting rules about what you can't do that it makes you understand more about the limitations on the ability to predict what will happen.
Well, you mentioned the Great Depression. I'm going to ask you to set that humility aside. What do we think actually did cause the Great Depression?
That's a good question. Well, clearly, having a large war, World War I, wasn't a great thing to have. And a lot of the issues that came in the interwar period were related to issues with reparations, which Keynes was quite knowledgeable about, for instance, and how we dealt with the European situation after that. And then there are these booms and busts in markets. I think that's some of the most interesting research has been about bubbles. We saw that again in 2008 with the bubble in housing. And so the issue about how markets can actually be non-rational, but they can be almost predictably non-rational. You're not going to be able to know exactly when the bubble will burst, but there are signs that show you that asset prices, for instance, may be untenably high.
See, now I think I want to take your classes. Now I think you should be in the classroom. And on the subject of, you said teaching feminist economics, for a student or a listener who says, wait, define that. What do you mean feminist economics? What do you mean?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. I mean, one thing is that economics was not a particularly gendered field, really, until fairly recently. And so we're big on homo economicus, for instance. We just say economic man. We never talked about economic people. And so just even having a model in economics that has two types of people, men and women, is a big step forward because it's hard to explain family structures unless you have some interaction in families. So a lot of it is just trying to line up economics more with the real world, where we know people interact within families and certain ways, within firms in ways that relate often to their gender roles in society as well, that looks at things like whether in some societies women have the right to own land or not, whether women have equal access to capital markets, the things we were talking about earlier about what kinds of occupations you find women in and where. There's just a lot of interesting patterns. And I find that students often like areas of economics where they can actually link them to things that they already have noticed in the real world but haven't really thought about in an analytical way. The other field I actually like to teach a lot, probably even more than gender, is urban economics, because it helps people understand the world around them, thinking about why countries and the space around us develop in the way they do, why we see those historical structures and how that affects the future, and even things like why you see gas stations all near each other as opposed to spread out across town, or why restaurants are often not full. Little things that you notice but you don't think about systematically. And economics is good at giving you mental frameworks to think about patterns you see and help you understand them better.
Talking to Dr. Joyce Jacobson, who is the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. We're broadcasting with our partners right here in Geneva at WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. We're going to take our only break of the hour, and when we come back, Tom will take your question. We've got others as well, and we're going to talk about a wide range of issues with the new president of HWS, Joyce Jacobson, after this break. Coming up in our second hour, Nate DeMayo is a nationally recognized podcaster who started his podcast called The Memory Palace before most people knew that podcasts were a thing. Well, now it's massively popular, acclaimed in the pages of The New Yorker, and he is coming to Rochester for the Fringe Festival. He was in Rochester, turning his gaze to our city. What did he find? We'll talk about memory with Nate DeMayo next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, broadcasting with our partners at Finger Lakes Public Radio. That's 89.5 FM all throughout the Finger Lakes, and we always appreciate not only the partnership, but really the regional work that we do together. We're a Rochester-based program. We are a Finger Lakes-based program. We're a Western New York-based program. And today we're sitting down with Dr. Joyce Jacobson, the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Let me get a couple of listener questions in here. This is from Joel. Joel writes to us a rather lengthy email, and I know Joel has taught at a number of different schools in our region. He writes, Geneva is the site of General Sullivan's 1779 scorched earth campaign against the Seneca. Geneva was the center of Seneca life, called Canandaigua. This fall is the 240th anniversary of the Sullivan campaign. Later in 1844, Peter Wilson, a Cayuga Indian, was the first American Indian graduate of Geneva Medical College and one of the earliest Native American graduates of any medical school. Given that the full name of Hobart and William Smith is the Colleges of the Seneca and the historical signposts I just mentioned, I have two questions. Number one, what will the colleges do to memorialize the genocidal campaign and work with the Seneca peoples to create effective programming pathways for Indigenous students on campus and acknowledge that place matters in the history of HWS? And also, when will the colleges get around to creating at least a minor program in American Indian and Indigenous studies?
Wow, those are
very specific.
That's
yeah.
Very specific. I appreciate that. I mean, I'm very interested in Native American and Indigenous work in general. I don't have time to go into my full background now, but my father was a linguist who actually worked with several tribes in the Pacific Northwest and also the Great Basin, partly to preserve their language structures. So he worked with the Washoe, who were in the Great Basin in the Reno area where I grew up, and also later on with the Macaw, who are famous for being one of the whaling tribes that operate right on the tip of the Northwest on the Olympic Peninsula. And in both cases, basically created written versions of their languages and basically turned over those materials to the tribes, partly so that they could actually maintain language work and study with their own members. So I've been very proud of him my whole life for his work. And I actually spent quite a lot of time, most summers actually growing up when I was a child, on the Macaw Reservation, interacting with the tribal members. And we were quite close to many of them. So this is very close to my heart and interest. I admit I don't know as much about the background and the tribes of this area. And I'm looking forward to learning more about that as well. I'm also interested in learning more about this history, just as at Wesleyan, I was actually one of the people responsible for dealing with the issues there with our NAGPRA program, for instance, and repatriation issues and issues related to the Indian land, which was also where Middletown and specifically Wesleyan was located. So I'm very aware of these important issues. I don't want to speak out of turn because I'm not fully educated on them. My understanding is that there are plans to celebrate that anniversary, or not celebrate, I shouldn't say that, to commemorate or acknowledge that at this point in time, just from talking to a couple students yesterday, actually. And going forward, I would be interested in understanding how we could do more with Native American studies. That was an area we were trying to go at Wesleyan as well. We had a regular postdoctoral program that we used there. there. We had money from the Mellon Foundation to hire a postdoctoral fellow to give classes in that in our American Studies department. And I'd be interested in understanding more about what the American Studies department does here at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. I'll admit I don't know the answer to that yet, but I'll certainly be working on that more in the time to come.
And I think Jill will appreciate that. And just to kind of follow up, my general observation about how we understand everything about this country and its history is that in my own upbringing and schooling, there was very little what I could remember now as an adult looking back as a realistic approach to the education of dispossession, of genocide, of our history with Indigenous peoples. Now with a seven-year-old son, and I have great respect for his teacher and his public school system, but I'm very guarded about what gets taught every November and what the lessons are and how they're sort of sanitized. Do you think we are making progress, generally speaking, and where does that progress need to be made?
Well, I think we are making progress, and it is interesting you mentioned, for instance, Thanksgiving or Columbus Day as another example now, which was interesting in Middletown because there was a large population of Italians in town, but also a great sensitivity about the Native American roots of that settlement area and a lot of conflict on those. So I think we are making progress. We're thinking more about the symbolic aspects of that. For instance, cases where various schools had teams named after Indians or Indians or Braves and things like that. And so we've had sensitivity on that, but sort of a deeper understanding of dispossession and the continuing issues that Indigenous peoples face in this country, I think many people do not have a good understanding. I thank my background for understanding more from that deep immersion in that nature that I had as a child, for thinking about that in a way that I don't think everybody had the ability to do. I think there's a long way to go still on that, and not just in this country, but many other countries, of thinking about dominant narratives of populations and just the incredible variety and diversity of both Indigenous and non-Indigenous groups that come to countries. I'm also very interested to learn what the other settlement groups were that came to this area and understanding these populations of people that come. I mean, I myself, of course, am immigrant background, as really, I guess we all are from some time zone, but I'm part Chinese American. So part of my family came over in the 19th century to California in about the 1880s, so actually a fairly old family for that area. And then I'm part Norwegian, so I had family that came into Minnesota, and then family that came from the East Coast, older parts that really date back to the American Revolution. So in my own family background, there are these multiple narratives and stories, not all of which I even really know or understand. And I think we need to acknowledge more of these subculture aspects of life and the rich diversity of people's attachment to land and their background, and not think, well, we're all Americans or we're all Chinese or all Norwegians even. There's so much variation. Even my Norwegian family apparently actually went from Denmark to Norway. So, you know, there's this constant migration and movement of people and settlement patterns that are just fascinating to look at, but often really get lost when we talk about national narratives.
And when you bring up sports teams and the invocation of different mascots, when you became president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, the schools put out just a short video, and you made remarks on a number of subjects. And I was struck by some of your comments about sports as sort of sports's place in academic settings is sort of uniquely American. And I wonder, maybe I was misperceiving it. I thought there was a hint of a little bit of discomfort with that. Or I don't want to speak for you, but what do you make of the way higher education and sports mix?
Oh, not at all. I'm actually a big fan of it. It's interesting, though, as you point out, for instance, European schools, club sports operate separately from universities for the most part. And they just don't even have athletic departments in the way that we do. I actually spent a lovely afternoon yesterday touring around with the two athletic directors at Hobart and William Smith of our facilities. And, you know, again, great facilities and really a lot of dedicated people there. I actually think that one of the great strengths of liberal arts institutions in particular, but colleges in general, is the ability to develop the whole person. And a serious athlete, I have great admiration for serious athletes that are really able to put in dedication, often work all 4 years with their teams and are still also able to maintain their studies. And I think it's a great balance that not only that teaches you time management and leadership skills as well, but that hopefully you learn how the skills you learn in one area actually transfer over to the other. And having the ability also for more casual recreation, having the fitness center, having club and intramural sports, it's just a wonderful way to combine the various aspects of your life and really model how hopefully you would lead a balanced life after leaving the colleges as well.
All right, so I want to turn to a subject that a number of our listeners have pointed in this direction leading up to this program. Hobart and William Smith is not alone among campuses that have seen questions about sexual assault on campus, about due process, and there was a case in the last week that I was not aware of until David French wrote a piece in National Review. The title of his piece was Amy Coney Barrett, he's referring to a judge, Amy Coney Barrett strikes a blow against campus kangaroo courts. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the piece about a case at Purdue. David French writes, quote, "Whenever I read a court opinion describing a campus sexual assault proceeding, I routinely find myself shocked at the staggering unfairness and ridiculous bias of campus kangaroo courts, driven by the need to find more men guilty and rationalized by a hashtag believe women ideology. Campus administrators have systematically discarded every fundamental notion of due process in American law." And then French describes what happened at Purdue, in which a female college student accused her ex-boyfriend of groping her in her sleep. Purdue University conducted an investigation, and eventually the student was found guilty and suspended for a year. But he complained that he was not allowed to provide any evidence on which decision makers could rely in determining guilt or punishment, that the woman making the claim was not asked to testify in person. And Judge Barrett, as French notes, was unsparing in her criticism of the university's procedures. She noted that Purdue's process, with its permanent, devastating consequences for the student's career, quote, fell short of what even a high school must provide to a student facing a days-long suspension. She was really tough on it. And David French's conclusion here is that this is just Purdue in one case, but he thinks this is American academia writ large. He thinks it is stacked against men and has jumped way too far of abandoning due process for men on campus. And when I hear from conservative listeners, I hear that a lot. That is not the full story that I always hear, but I'm generalizing here, but I hear that a lot. I want to get your take on what you just heard there.
Well, it is one of the most interesting and challenging areas for college administrators is dealing with Title IX issues. We actually just hired a wonderful new person as our new Title IX administrator at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Perhaps you want to have him on someday to talk. Mm-hmm. And we run a full office here. That said, I mean, I think all schools have really grappled with the issue of how to handle this situation, which is very fraught and charged, not surprisingly, given the subject matter. And we're also in kind of a limbo right now of understanding what the directives are coming from the federal government. As you know, we've had a holdup on what the new directives are, and so we're all kind of waiting around to see what the new rules will be and how we will react to them. I think at the colleges, we are going to work in tandem in part with our partners in the New York 6 Consortium, where we have a consortium of schools including Hamilton, Colgate, Skidmore, Union, and St. Lawrence, and really try to work together so that we can come up with a plan on the view that six college heads are better than one of how to respond to these concerns, because I think all six of these schools are certainly very concerned that we not be viewed in that way and that we not operate in a way in which we are automatically favoring one type of person over another or not giving fair hearings or due process. But it is challenging to work within the rules. And certainly when things first started down this road on college campuses, I think a lot of schools found it difficult to know how to respond. There were potentially mistakes made, which are understandable, again, when you're in a new situation by administrators. And we've learned a lot from that, and I think come to a situation that is working better in many cases now and really trying to understand and let both sides be heard. That said, also, these are still, while they're not lawsuits, they are still closed hearings. And so it's often not the case that everybody knows what really happened in the hearing or what the truth is. Certainly, as a college administrator, there are many things that I know that I often say I know many things that I wish people wouldn't tell me, because often I can't tell anybody else afterwards, and it's just, you know, sort of builds up as a burden. So there are some people who know the full story, but for numerous legal reasons, we can't always tell the full stories or make clear everything that's heard. I know that's frustrating for people because people want to know the truth and hear the whole narrative. But that's kind of life, unfortunately, that you don't always get to hear everything for a variety of reasons. And it's very tricky terrain.
All right, let me get a phone call on line one. This is Luis on with Joyce Jacobson. Dr. Jacobson is the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Go ahead, Luis.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, so Dr. Jacobson, I took your introduction to economics 25 years ago.
Oh.
So I'm very excited to have you around.
Cool. Come by and visit me. That's great.
So I was wondering about endowments and the universities. You know, I think that there's always been a challenge in Wesleyan on how to make accessible education and the high cost of education. And how do you see this progressing as in your new role?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's a challenge. Even Wesleyan, that has over $1 billion now, much higher than when we were both there 25 years ago. And Hobart and William Smith, that is more about $230 million. They're still considered under-endowed because it is so expensive to provide the kind of access that both institutions really want to provide, so that basically when we identify people that we want to have at the colleges and we know will do well and probably prosper better at the colleges than at other options, it can be very expensive to provide those rides. And one of my main goals as president will be to raise more funds for financial aid. And I'm perfectly comfortable with having endowment funds that are restricted to financial aid because, again, it's endless need for that and to really make sure that we provide sufficient aid to increase access for everyone.
But I also know that, like, for example, President Bennett, who was the president when I was there, there was this kind of two visions in terms of the student body, one as kind of as a customer of education and the other one is more in terms of the kind of like challenging the next generation. So, you know, like I think that some universities nowadays have to choose between like food service, for example, where they have like these fabulous options for food versus opportunities for financial aid.
Yeah.
How do you see that happening?
Well, right, I will.
Luis, thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
I will always lean towards things that are central to the academic mission. So both academic mission and preserving the academic mission, preserving faculty lines, and also increasing aid over, as President Roth, our current president at Wesleyan, likes to say, the lazy river approach to building things. So we really have to say on the margin what things are not necessary. There are arms races that some schools participate in, and I think we just have to be strong and withstand that. And Wesleyan's been good at withstanding that. And I hope to have that kind of discipline. I think that's been the case here as well, and maintain that discipline here as well.
And at the risk of simplifying, because our time is starting to run short here, we've had whole conversations on trying to better understand higher ed endowments, which are probably misunderstood often, and sticker price versus actual price in terms of tuition, room, board. But we still know that student loan debt's over $1 trillion in this country. What's one thing that Hobart and William Smith can do to make sure your students are graduating with maybe less debt than the average?
Well, one thing I think I'm very proud of, again, at both of these schools that I've been affiliated with, is our ability to actually graduate people. I think one of the main reasons why people should send their children to schools like Hobart and William Smith is that we have higher graduation rates, higher retention and graduation rates than if you send a child to a public college. Public colleges have a lot to do, and one of the things they can't do as well is really try to make sure they're following people, looking and seeing who's in fear of dropping out, who's having trouble completing their major. And it is so important to try to graduate within, say, 8 semesters. And Wesleyan's always really held the line on that, said, we will not charge you for more than 8 semesters, and we will get you through. And I'm hoping we can do that to the extent fully possible at the colleges as well.
We have some presidential candidates who want to pass legislation that would effectively wipe out some or all of student loan debt. Do you want to see that happen?
Well, I guess the question is who pays for that? So again, as in many ways a fiscal conservative, I am concerned about the increased deficit and the debt level, and I would like to understand how exactly we're going to finance that and whether it actually allows us to provide a high quality of education if, for instance, part of it is by, say, cutting the payments that colleges now receive both from the federal and the state governments.
All right, last couple of minutes. You've written about a fun subject for me, the economics of wine. You're in a wine region now. now. You're in a fabulous wine region. But on the economics of wine, wine as an investment, should we be investing in wine?
No. You should drink it instead.
That's generally what the research has found. Would it have been different if we could go back 30 or 40 years in time and buy first growth Bordeaux for a much lower sticker cost?
Well, it's always, if you knew to buy it back in the day, if you knew to buy Old Masters back when Van Hoff was making his paintings, sure, it's great if you get in the ground floor. But by the time markets get developed, usually a lot of the gains have already gone. At this point, you know, no looking back. You just keep moving forward and just drink all that great wine you guys are producing around here.
I'd like to go back in time and buy Bitcoin, of all things.
Well, there too. Yeah, I'm regretting that also.
Dr. Jacobson, I hope that you enjoyed the time here. And is there a particular, I was going to ask you if there's a particular wine. I hope there's a variety. I hope you're a Riesling fan. You're in the Riesling capital of America.
I do like Riesling, particularly dry Riesling.
Last question as we get ready to wrap the program here. What does a successful tenure for you look like? Give me either a benchmark or a way that you're going to look back on your time, however long you're here at HWS, and say, it was successful if what happened?
Well, I want to leave it a better place than I found it. And so I think part of it, thinking about Luisa's question, I mean, part of it is I would like to see the endowment be much larger, because that's really the future for the institution, is building that endowment and making sure they're on a sound fiscal path into the future.
Was it pretty cool to hear from a former student?
It was. That was really cool.
Does that happen often?
Occasionally, but not usually when I'm on a radio show, so that's what's pretty cool.
Well, I want to tell you that we appreciate the time. We come down here with some regularity because we've got such great partners at WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. They are an institution, and we're proud to be broadcasting with them. We hope that we can talk to you again and the great team at HWS, and let's do this again.
Great. Thanks so much.
Dr. Joyce Jacobson is the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, just days on the job officially, and the first woman ever in that role. So for all of us here at WEOS, let's go ahead and thank everyone. Greg, Kelly, the whole team here who every day puts up with us, our last minute requests, and all of the things that we ask them to help us with. They're just wonderful partners. Megan Mack is producing on site here back in Rochester. We've got a whole team behind the glass, including Rob Braden, Gary Putup, and more. Thanks to everyone. We've got much more connections coming up next hour.